This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now, here is your host for JAMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will place a well-deserved spotlight on JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association, and introduce this new member of the AMDA On The Go podcast family for regularly offering highlights of JAMDA themes and articles. With us now, we have JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Sloan, thank you for joining me on this inaugural edition of JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you, Wayne. I've been impressed at what you've been doing here at AMDA On The Go, and it's great to join you again.
Wonderful. Dr. Sloan, as we introduce this new podcast series, I wanted to take a moment to reflect on the journal specifically. How has JAMDA evolved since its first issue came out in January of 2000?
Well, tell you the truth, my involvement with AMDA preceded my involvement with JAMDA. I liked AMDA because clinicians that I really respected got involved there. I liked the clinical orientation and then became aware of how good of a journal JAMDA was becoming. And we owe the journal's rise to Dan Osterweil and John Morley, both of whom are past editors. Dan did a great job of building the journal. John made it international and research focused. And our goal is to keep the international and research focus while moving it to include more clinically relevant papers so that practitioners in the trenches will find value equal to that of the academics.
You know, can you just tell us a little bit about what impact, speaking about internationally and nationally, what impact does JAMA have today in post-acute care, in geriatrics, et cetera?
Well, all I can say is that Cheryl and I try to provide things that will be useful to the field. In terms of the impact, we can't judge that, but I could mention a few things. First, we look for research that is high quality, that has relevance for practice and or policy. Several editorials have been written about this that we've done. Secondly, we do write an editorial monthly, and one of our goals in writing editorials and also in putting theme issues together is to shed light on relevant topics that help clarify issues. A recent one we did on why media tend to report only bad news about long-term care. We were gratified to see that Dr. Jeff, whose column in Caring for the Ages, I read regularly, quoted that editorial.
Amazing. And of course, when you mentioned Cheryl, you mean the co-editor-in-chief, yes. Dr. Cheryl Zimmerman.
Right. A couple other things. In October, we have an editorial coming out in which we're trying to broaden the dialogue on major problems of aging beyond cognitive impairment. And we're going to talk about lower extremity impairment. And a third point I'd like to make is I just can't emphasize enough that the involvement of providers across the post-acute and long-term care continuum is important in research and writing. Academic research, you know, it's a laboratory. It's laboratory stuff. And it's only when the community practitioners and community care settings get involved that we can generate research that really has relevance and generalizability.
And I must say that you have put together a crack panel of editors, including your senior editor, Dr. Paul Katz, really wonderful people to help advocate and grow the journal.
Thank you.
Dr. Sloan, for a number of years, AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, has collaborated with a number of other societies, including the American College of Emergency Physicians, specifically to augment knowledge and establish an understanding of and appreciation for the needs of the post-acute patient and the long-term care resident, especially when it comes to transitions. So this August 2019 issue of JAMDA has a number of articles that focus on the emergency room / skilled nursing facility or SNF relationship specifically. In an editorial entitled "Increasing the Value of Emergency Visits for Long-Term Care Patients When Less is More and More is More," emergency medicine physician Timothy Platts-Mills, Cheryl Zimmerman, and you render an important comment, reflection, which some might find surprising as it is often not expressed in our post-acute world. Namely, not all emergency department visits are bad. As you considered the articles for this edition of JAMDA, were you seeking to help us understand the value of emergency care for individuals residing in long-term care?
Yes, we were. The way I think about it, I think of emergency care kind of like antibiotics. Really valuable for the right patient. But if you overuse them, then you have adverse effects.
Yeah.
And that's really the point of the editorial. We don't want to avoid the emergency department when it's needed or when it's not necessary. We'd rather manage things in the outpatient setting.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from Afoundria, the creators of ChartPath. Our world is changing, and the demands on your practice are growing. Nobody wants to just buy an EHR. You want a technology partner by your side. That's why they built ChartPath, a simple-to-manage and simple-to-use EHR backed by a dedicated team 24/7 that will guide your practice through MIPS and help you manage your growth. Most importantly, ChartPath is efficient, so you can continue to give your patients the high level of care you are known for and still make it home in time for dinner.
We're speaking with Dr. Philip Sloan as we spotlight some notable articles now from the August 2019 issue of JAMDA. Dr. Sloan, let's now talk about some specific articles with this emergency room theme. Dr. Cameron Gettle and others focus on improving documentation on transitions to the emergency room. Not a new idea, but what specifically made their information stand out for you to put it in JAMDA?
Well, I should say that I worked for 6 years in a rural emergency department that my department runs about 40 miles southeast of Chapel Hill. I stopped just a few years ago, so the memories are quite fresh. And what I observed is when a nursing home resident came to the emergency department, unless it was something simple like changing a feeding tube, the patients were usually admitted because the staff just didn't really understand how to work with a long-term care system. I know geriatric medicine, and I know how nursing homes function, so I could get on the phone and call the nursing home, and I knew who to talk to, and I knew what to ask. And so I sent more people home. And so it leads to the topic of the paper, which is the importance of transfer information. Mm-hmm. Because the emergency docs are not going to always call up and get the information that's not there, and it's just easier to make a disposition even in the absence of correct information. So this was a study of a random sample of nursing home residents transferred to three emergency departments and a health system in Rhode Island. The investigators reviewed a sample of 456 hospital electronic records, including the transfer documentation. And by the way, 70% of these people were admitted.
Yes.
They looked for data that had been shown by the INTERACT project to improve transitions in care. And they found that medication lists, past medical history and resuscitation status were usually there. But the things that emergency physicians most need to make a decision were often absent. You know, usual mental status, usual functional status, and the reason for transfer. All these were present in fewer than 30% of the records.
Mm-hmm.
Even vital signs prior to the transfer were present in only 2/3 of the transfer paperwork. So these are things that ER docs really need. So key take-home points from this paper, they're not new, but it's good to remind us. Be explicit on the reason for the transfer, what we really want the emergency department to help us decide, and that medical directors should work with the facilities to assure a standardized method of documenting the baseline mental status and functional status and sending it to the emergency department.
Absolutely crucial for our colleagues in the trenches, as you said. Let's talk about another article, this one by Dr. Suzanne Gillespie, who has become a leader in the use of telemedicine for post-acute and long-term care. She discusses with her colleagues a way in which to use telemedicine to reduce transitions to the emergency department for older adults with dementia. Tell us a little bit about what they proposed.
Well, the clinical question they sought to address was, what should a clinician do when they get a phone call from somebody who has dementia and is at home and is having some kind of medical problem? Usually, the clinician has three choices. You advise on the telephone, you send him to the clinic, or you direct him to the emergency department. Mm-hmm. In this study, what they did was they added a fourth option, an in-home telemedicine consultation, sort of like a virtual house call.
Right.
The telemedicine visit, it involved a technician who was similar to a nursing assistant coming to the patient's home and following a protocol that, depending on the problem, could include history, vital signs, video of the patient, audio of heart and lung sounds. They packaged all this together and then uploaded it on the cloud. The clinician reviewed it, and then there was a phone conversation between the family member and the physician with this facilitator there. So they studied 214 community-dwelling persons with dementia and their caregivers and compared them with a control group. The results found that the experimental group had 24% fewer emergency department visits than the control group. So the take-home points for me are, figuring out some way to see a patient with an acute problem in their home setting is important for preventing emergency department visits. One way is a home visit by a physician or a nurse practitioner, but much more efficient is this method the project identified, which is to have a less expensive individual go to the home, gather preliminary data, and then mediate a remote visit between the clinician, the patient, and the caregiver. These are, in the traditional fee-for-service system, this is difficult, but as we move toward value-based care, it appears that such visits will help prevent unnecessary transfers, and such an approach might especially work for senior care communities, long-term care settings, and particularly capitated programs.
And telemedicine has certainly become a focus for the society as well. And just a third article that I thought was very interesting was a model proposed by Dr. Daniel Stadler and his colleagues from Dartmouth-Hitchcock and Mass General Hospital on this RAFT RAFT model, which, when utilized, minimized significantly emergency department care for SNF patients. What's this RAFT model?
You know, I agree with you. This is a particularly useful study for and on the go listeners. And the reason is because it describes how long-term care practices can achieve a 35% reduction in emergency department transfers and a 30% reduction in hospitalizations with a simple set of policies and procedures and not needing any new technology. So here's what they did. In brief, a small long-term care focused medical group provides care to a large continuing care retirement community in New England. As part of a quality initiative, they developed this program, which has four parts. First, and this is most important, a small team of providers manage longitudinal care and after-hours call. So they have an internal group, and they don't farm out after-hours call or weekend call. Then they systematically elicit advanced care plans so that they don't hospitalize anybody that doesn't want to be hospitalized. They don't overtreat someone who wants treatment limited. Then the next part, which is probably the most critical, is increase engagement, what they call engagement of the provider during the acute visit. And what they do is they tell the staff, call us first.
Yes.
Don't call the family. You know, don't call the ambulance. Call the provider. The provider's available and wants to be involved in the decision-making from the beginning. And the provider knows the advanced directives, has access to information about the patient, and it short-circuits the staff panicking and sending some to the emergency department when, in fact, some more basic problem-solving might help them stay in the facility.
Absolutely.
So they also, this is another one more thing they do, they have a case review twice a month to discuss the most recent hospital transfers, and that way, as a group, they learn strategies to best manage these acute problems when they occur. The key take-home point from this paper is creating a systematic policy of getting the medical provider involved early in an acute event is critical to preventing unnecessary transfers and hospitalizations.
Absolutely. And for those teams that are already practicing this model without calling it this model, at least having this study validates that this really is a very proactive and appropriate way to help manage patients if you're able to do so. So another wonderful study. Dr. Sloan, a few more JAMDA articles not under the emergency room theme from the August 2019 issue, I think also merit some mention, as they really do seem to impact our fellow providers in the trenches, which is your goal. For example, you know, the society has advocated for increasing competencies for clinicians providing nursing facility care. So with regard to one article, is there evidence that nursing home specialists positively impact quality?
Well, this is an article from a team from the University of Pennsylvania, and the question they sought to address was whether nursing home specialists, SNFs, as we call them, provide higher quality care than non-SNFs. They used Medicare billing data and MDS data to examine this, and they looked at 6 nursing home compare quality measures. We could argue how important these are, but they are certainly being measured. Right. One of them was a short stay measure in terms of new antipsychotic prescriptions, and they had 5 long stay resident measures: antipsychotic use, rate of UTI diagnoses, how many residents had indwelling bladder catheters, physical restraint use, and then the prevalence of depressive symptoms as reported by the patient or staff assessment using the MDS. What they found was that 2 of these measures improved. Antipsychotics were reduced in long-stay residents, and fewer bladder catheters were used. These, in my estimation, are particularly important clinically, though I'd also like to see the UTI diagnosis rate go down. Prevalence of depressive symptoms was higher, and I don't know whether this is a negative outcome or whether it's just an indication of better surveillance. I don't know, but I think the bottom line is there's some evidence here to go to an administrator and say, hey, look, having a more specialized medical group manage your patients may improve key outcomes.
Another paper that really I found fascinating, only because it really spoke to the essence of the training that we all receive around dehydration. There are specific clinical factors that we look for in identifying dehydration in nursing home residents. And a study looked at this. How well are we doing in our assessment?
Well, let's face it, it's a can of worms. Hopefully this article has just helped reinforce the fact that it's hard clinically to determine whether somebody's dehydrated or not.
Fascinating.
But they did shed some light on it. I think we have to recall that somewhere around 30-40% of nursing home residents are dehydrated at any given time. They're chronically dehydrated a little bit, they're functioning okay, but it's something we really need to be attuned to, because then they can tip over very quickly into more clinically severe dehydration. So this was a remarkably detailed protocol in which investigators studied 188 nursing home residents across 56 care homes. They had 49 different clinical signs that had to be documented and recorded. And then they drew a serum osmolality and used that as the gold standard. Now, we can argue about that, but it is appearing to be more and more a gold standard for dehydration. And just to reiterate recapitulate, under 295 is considered normal. 295 to 300 is considered impending dehydration, and over 300 is diagnostic of overt dehydration. So of these 49 clinical signs, none was that perfect of an indicator. Those with the best area under the curve, which is kind of a way of measuring clinical accuracy, it combines sensitivity and specificity, they had an area under the curve between 0.6 and 0.7, which is okay, but not all that great. And these were skin turgor on the inside of the forearm, which apparently is the least saggy area in older persons. And then the diastolic blood pressure reduction 3 minutes after standing, or the pulse pressure rise or change 3 minutes after standing. They also talked about a Cochrane review of 67 clinical signs and symptoms of dehydration, which found that similar findings, although they also talked about expressing fatigue, which we've noticed clinically, missing drinks between meals, in other words, a history of hydration, and then bioelectrical impedance analysis, which is probably harder to do routinely in a nursing home. So the bottom line for me here is to have a high index of suspicion for chronic dehydration, but be skeptical and not nihilistic about clinical signs. The best thing to do is get your postural blood pressure and pulse. And then add to that a decent history of low or decreased oral intake, if you can obtain that. And finally, skin turgor on the inside of the forearm might be a little bit helpful. They had one other interesting but not very useful fact, and that is if you stick your finger in the patient's mouth and feel the inside of the cheek and it's dry, there's 99% specificity for dehydration, but it's only 3% sensitive.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal study. You know, the last article I wanted to review in this series is something that we all have a reflexive action against, and that is the individual that coughs after eating and drinking, or the laryngeal cough. So there's actually an article that took a look at this very important issue. So what was the potential impact of a laryngeal cough reflex on respiratory disease and mortality?
I should emphasize that this study was done of community dwelling individuals and not in long-term care setting. I'll talk about this again in a little bit, but the question is, what does it mean when somebody coughs when they drink? It was a massive longitudinal study of over nearly 33,000 community dwelling persons, 65 and older in Japan, who were enrolled and followed for 6 years. At baseline, what they did is they asked them if they ever experienced coughing when drinking, and 17% said yes. And I think they were getting people who coughed at least every once in a while. Then in the 6 years of longitudinal follow-up, initially when they looked at mortality, it looked like the group that coughed had a 46% greater chance of dying. But the cough group was older, so they had to adjust for old age, you know, for age, and the risk went down to 24%. And then they further adjusted for illnesses and socioeconomic factors, other things that probably were not related to the cough, but are related to mortality. And the hazard ratio went down to 1.1, which means that there's a 10% increase in risk of death over 6 years if somebody coughs when they drink, at least occasionally. So one bottom line to me is that coughing occasionally when drinking is probably no big deal. Mm-hmm. There could be just a few other factors they haven't identified. Although, once again, if there's there is a connection between coughing and respiratory disease, which they commented on, but they weren't able to tease out enough to really say much. So while the paper appropriately concluded that coughing during drinking is associated with a modest increase in mortality, I found it largely reassuring and would therefore make very little of an occasional cough while drinking. Of course, the challenge is figuring out whether these data help inform decisions on persons who cough or choke repeatedly while eating. But that's a little different situation. It really doesn't help us. It's more in our ambulatory folks that these are helpful. The ones who cough or choke repeatedly challenge us in post-acute long-term care practice, and this paper is not really about them. So a little bit of information, but a lot of questions remain.
Just a few of the excellent articles in the August 2019 Journal of the American Medical Director Association. Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief, Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look. Dr. Sloan, thank you for spending your time with JAMDA on the Go, and we look forward to future podcasts.
Thank you, and happy to be there.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com and www.jamda.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast's title. Thank you.